This is the second Sunday of Lent, and if you haven't been with us, this is a special season in the life of our church and just in life of the Christian community in general. We're doing a couple things together as a community. We're reading through the book of Matthew, sort of on this journey with Jesus during this season. And so you can grab one of these cards on your way out, and it'll tell you a little bit more about Lent, what it's all about, and how to join us. We're only in the second week, and there's 6 weeks, so it's not too late to sort of jump in and read along with us. So grab that on your way out. And then also, during Lent, people often fast from something. And so maybe you're giving something up, and that can sometimes be really good. One of the things I'm giving up during Lent is the news. And it's been amazing. I have no idea what crazy things are happening in our world right now, and I don't miss it at all. So that's been good, but maybe you're giving something up that's been a bit hard as well. You're 10 days in and you're thinking, why in the world am I fasting from this? Why am I giving this up? There's 30 more days to go. I don't know if I can make it. But here's the good news. Even though Lent is primarily about this idea of fasting, today we're going to talk about feasting. So, yes, that's reason to celebrate. Let me give you some background. Last week we read a story about a guy named John the Baptist. This is the very beginning of Matthew. John the Baptist was a preacher in Israel during Jesus' lifetime. And so the introduction to Jesus' story actually starts with John. And John is in the wilderness. He brings these people out in the wilderness, and he's preaching this message, and he's basically saying, God is up to something new. Like God's kingdom. God is coming back to Israel. He's going to restore the nation, and he's bringing himself, and he's returning. And so prepare for that and be ready to embrace this new thing or this new life that God is doing. And then Jesus comes along after John the Baptist, and it looks like Jesus is maybe even the fulfillment of that. Somehow Jesus takes that same message, and he talks about some of those things as well. And he comes out of nowhere. He's a nobody. Nobody knows who he is, and yet he's clearly a teacher. He's like one of the rabbis, and so he begins teaching people and drawing people to himself. He gives these long messages. There's one long one called the Sermon on the Mount. It's included in Matthew. And his teaching is powerful. And it's unique. It's different than all the other teachers. And so people start following him, and he actually invites people to follow him. Begin to follow me. Be my apprentice or be my disciple and follow in my ways, and I'll teach you what I know, and I'll teach you how to live. And so some people start following him. But then Jesus starts doing some pretty interesting things. He starts healing people, like literally healing people from their diseases and their physical diseases and illnesses. And then he actually heals somebody who's the son of, or the servant of, a Roman centurion. And that's odd, because the Romans are the enemy. Like, the Romans are the oppressors. Israel is living under the oppression of the Romans. In fact, what they were waiting for and longing for, the kingdom was going to be to throw off the Romans and restore the nation to its former glory. And here Jesus is healing or helping this Roman military person. That doesn't make sense. And then he heals one guy one day, and then he says to him, after he heals him, your sins are forgiven. Wait a second, people are saying, I thought only God could forgive our sins, and you're saying his sins are forgiven? That sounds like blasphemy. And so Jesus begins to raise all these questions, particularly among some of the Jewish leaders. And then we come to another story, and this is what it says in Matthew chapter 9, starting in verse 9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. So Jesus is at the Sea of Galilee, which is this large lake up in the northern part of Israel, and he comes down to the shores of the lake, and there's a customs booth there. It's basically a customs station, because on the other, it's a really big lake, and on the other side of the lake are different provinces. And so when boats came in and merchants carrying goods, they had to basically check in at the customs station a lot. Like when we leave the country or when we come back into the country, you have to go through customs. And so there's this customs station there, and Matthew is the customs agent. And yet a customs agent doesn't just stamp your passport in those days. He's a tax collector, because when you checked in at the station, you had to pay taxes. because the Romans collected taxes for you to do business across the lake whenever you came into this new province. And so Matthew's sitting there, and if you grew up in church or you've heard these stories before, you probably know that people didn't view these tax collectors too highly. Because essentially they're working for the Romans, who are the enemy and are the oppressors. They're collecting your taxes, which are money you don't want to pay to your enemies or the oppressors. And then the tax collectors even charge an additional amount on top of that so that they could make money themselves. And so if you're a Jewish tax collector, it's like you're betraying your own people. You're doing this at the expense of your own people. And so these tax collectors are basically custom agents were seen as the scum of society. These are the people that are despised because they're horrible. And so while most people would curse them under their breath, never look them in the eye and sort of see them as the enemy or the losers or the scum, Jesus walks up to this station. And we don't know exactly what happens, but you can only imagine. It's almost like he looks him in the eyes and says, "What's your name? Where are you from, Matthew? How long have you been collecting taxes? Do you like it? Do you enjoy it? Do you always want to do this? Would you be interested in doing something else? You want to be a part of something bigger and way better? Why don't you follow me?" Now, we don't know if that's how the whole story went. We're probably just getting a condensed version of it. But Matthew is engaged by Jesus. Jesus comes up and actually talks to him and asks him to follow him. Look at what happens next. While Jesus, verse 10, was having dinner at Matthew's house. Now, let's stop there. When does this happen? Is this that night? Like, is that where you want me to follow you back to my house? Like, is that what happened? Is this a couple of days later? Did Matthew invite Jesus over to his house? Did Jesus invite himself over to Matthew's house? We just don't know the details, but the next scene is basically Jesus having dinner at Matthew's house. And that's a very intimate thing in this culture. I mean, in any culture, really, when you invite someone into your house, I mean, that you don't invite strangers. You invite people that you know or people that at least you're forming or forging a new relationship with. And then there's always a sense of like, do we clean up or do we leave it dirty? Like, where are we at this? You know, you're going to introduce them to your family. If you have family, they're going to see where you live. You're going to have long conversations. They're going to see the kind of food you eat. And in that culture, this was an extraordinary thing. Like, you sat down and ate with people, and you were going to spend hours doing it with people that were like family to you. I mean, we live in a more of a fast food culture now, and so eating is sort of just a task to get to the next thing. But in that culture, it was extremely meaningful and rich. And here Jesus is, either that day or maybe within a few days, taking the next step and having dinner at Matthew's house. But it goes on. Look at this. It says, the verse continues. It says, while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. Now, this is interesting. The phrase tax collectors and sinners is shorthand in that language and in that culture for all the losers, basically. Like all the people that no one else likes or no one else likes to hang out with. I mean, this is the category, especially for good Jews, for the Jewish leaders, and even the Jewish sort of middle classes, normal people. This was the category at the bottom of society. All the people you despise, basically. So why are there just tax collectors and sinners there? I mean, why are those the people that Matthew invites? Well, probably because that's the only other people he knew. Those are the only other people he hung out with. I mean, can you imagine when Jesus says, like, hey, can I come over? And why don't you invite all your friends? Matthew's like, do you know my friends, Jesus? Because my people are not like your people. And like, I've seen your friends, nice guys, but my friends are not like that. Like, it's going to be a bit rowdy if I invite all of my friends. Are you sure you want to hang out? because I don't really know anybody. I mean, all my friends are other tax collectors, right? They're the prostitutes that we sleep with. Like, they're the people that you guys make fun of and hate. Are you sure that's who you want to eat with? And Jesus said, yeah. Invite all your friends. And I'm going to bring my friends, and it'll be interesting. And so they sit down. And as you can imagine, this raises even more questions about Jesus. Because look at what happens in the next verse. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Now, remember, the Pharisees are a group of Jewish leaders, and honestly, they get a bad rap. These are people who are trying. They were sincerely pious. They wanted to follow God's laws and God's rules, and they read the Bible, and they went to church, and they did all the right things in their mind. And in fact, they believed that the way to experience God and to experience this kingdom that Jesus talked about was to prepare your hearts and prepare your lives and to get your life in order and to do all the right things and make sure you obeyed all the right laws. And so purity was really important for them. And if you're doing everything you can to like obey the rules and do all the right things and not do all the wrong things, then you certainly don't want to hang out with people that do all the wrong things and never do the right things. So in their minds, this just does not compute. It doesn't add up. Jesus, why are you? And they don't even ask Jesus. Maybe they're scared of Jesus. We don't know. Does this happen that night? Do they like look into the window and see what's going on? And like, no, probably not. This might be a day or two later. Maybe they're at the marketplace and they see some of Jesus' disciples. And so they pull them aside and they've heard the rumors about what happened the other night where Jesus and his disciples were eating with. Maybe they saw him going in. Maybe they heard the raucous laughter coming out of the house. We don't know. But they pull the disciples aside. Why does Jesus eat with these people? Why is he talking to these people? Why is he hanging out? Why does he care about these people? And here's what I think happened. I think the disciples heard that question and thought, that's a great question. We have no idea. Because it was awkward. Like, it was strange. I mean, we got there, and that group of people, I mean, they didn't pray before the meal. And if you could have heard some of the stories they were telling and the language they use, I mean, it was just, I mean, we've been meaning to ask Jesus the same thing. Why are we hanging out with these people? I don't know if that's what they thought, but I imagine they do, because then they went back to Jesus himself and they basically said, people are asking, and we're kind of wondering too, why did we do that? Jesus responds, next verse, on hearing this, Jesus said, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. It's not the healthy who need a doctor. And it's pretty clear Jesus is the doctor, right? I mean, he's been actually going around healing people, and you don't heal people who are healthy. You heal people who are sick. You heal people who have problems. And so if you think Matthew and all his friends have so many problems and are so sick, then it makes obvious sense why I'm hanging out with them. I came to heal them, to help them, to care for them. And then Jesus turns back into the rabbi and he says, but go and learn what this means. That was sort of a rabbinical way of teaching where they would quote a rabbinical saying from another rabbi or a passage from the Torah or the Old Testament. And they would basically say, all right, what do you think this means? So he says, go and learn what this means. And then he quotes a verse from the book of Hosea. And Hosea was written hundreds of years before. Hosea was a prophet, and God spoke through Hosea to the leaders of Israel in about 700 or 800 BC. Because at that time, the leaders of Israel were arrogant, and they were proud, and they were proud of all the religious rituals and all the things they were doing, and they thought that they were doing all the right things, and that meant that they were in, and everyone else in the world was out, and they were pleasing God. And so God spoke through the prophet Isaiah to say to these leaders of Israel at that time, look, I don't really care about all of your sacrifices and your religious rituals and all of the things you do if you're not merciful. Because mercy is at the center of all of it. I mean, the reason you're here is God's mercy. And then you're to go out and show that mercy to other people. In fact, that's what you do when you offer a sacrifice. You're basically coming to God and you're confessing your sin and your need for mercy. And you're giving, in that time, the sacrificial system, you're giving this sacrifice to ask God to show you mercy. And it should transform you and change you so that you go out and show and live out that same mercy to other people. So God challenged the people of Israel. And it's almost like Jesus is pointing back to that passage and basically pointing to the Pharisees and saying, you're the same way. You are so consumed with all your religious festivals and your feasts and your worship services and your sacrifices and your rituals and your rules, and you're defining the boundaries of who's in and who's out. And I'm not against sacrifices or religious rituals. There's a place and a time, and those are good. You could hear Jesus saying, but if that's what you're consumed with and there's no mercy, they're hollow. They're bankrupt. They don't mean anything. So mercy's got to be at the center of it. And then Jesus basically says, and here's the deal. I haven't come to call righteous people. I came for sinners. I didn't come for people who think they have their lives all together. I came for the people who know they don't and know that they need me. Now, we could stop right there and pause and just ask the question. And if you're reading along in the devotional that we're doing as a community, it's great because oftentimes the writer, N.T. Wright, will sort of stop and say, where are you in this story? And so let's do that right now. Where are you in this story? Do you feel like Matthew? Do you feel like you've made your life a bit of a mess? Like even when you come to church, you kind of don't fit in here because it looks like everyone else's lives is together and they're happy and their kids are great and, you know, and that's not your life. And do you hear Jesus saying to you, you're not a mess? Sure, your life is a mess. Yeah, but you are not a mess. And I love you and I care for you and I want you to experience new life, and you're significant to me and you're important and you can actually be a part of something significant that's happening in this world. I mean, think about it. Matthew goes from being the despised to a follower to a guy that then writes a book that changed the world. And do you feel like maybe Jesus is inviting you into that today? Or maybe you're like one of the other disciples. You're sitting there and you're trying to follow Jesus. Maybe you've even been doing it for a long time. And yet Jesus keeps turning your categories upside down and challenging you. And the more you read about him, the more he starts sort of messing with your expectations, your understanding of how God works. And it's unsettling at times. Or do you feel like one of the Pharisees? Would you identify with one of the Pharisees? Of course not. Right? Would any of us identify with, would any of us admit that we would identify? Of course not. None of us think we're Pharisees. But let's ask the question, when's the last time you spent a lot of time with someone that was totally different than you? When's the last time that you actually engaged and talked to and cared for someone whose life, whose actions, whose behaviors, whose lifestyle, whose beliefs were totally different? Maybe they were in the category of loser for you, or sinner. Or maybe not even that. Maybe they have a great life, but they have a whole different set of assumptions. When's the last time you spent significant time with someone like that? Well, and I'm not talking about like people you work with that you kind of have to spend time with. And then at 5 o'clock, you're glad to go home because you don't spend any time outside of the workplace with those kinds of people. When's the last time you invited one of those kinds of people to your house for dinner? You shared a meal with them. When's the last time someone like that felt comfortable enough and loved enough and accepted enough by you to invite you over to their house for dinner. You see, maybe we're a little bit more like the Pharisees than we often think we're not. Now, we could stop there, but something happens right after this story that often seems disconnected. We read through the book of Matthew, and it seems like we've shifted to sort of another scenario, but it's actually integrally connected to what happened. So let's read on just a little bit more. Verse 14, then John's disciples came and asked him, how is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast? Remember John, and this introduces us to a whole other group. Now there's Jesus' disciples, the Pharisees, and sort of John's disciples. So John the Baptist, remember him? He had gathered this crowd out in the desert, out in the wilderness, and people had gotten fired up about his message because they wanted the new life that God was bringing. And so they were leaving their sins, and they were confessing their sins, and they were acknowledging all these messed up things in their lives, and they were being baptized. That's how he gets the name John the Baptist, because he started baptizing people in the river as a way to acknowledge their sins and repent and turn towards God. And it seems like John was pretty big on fasting. Like fasting was the way to prepare yourself. Fasting was the way to turn away from some of those things in your life. Or even if you're just giving up food, to say, I'm going to let go of this thing for a while and sort of grieve over my sin and be sorrowful over it. And I'm going to make space for God to move in my life. If Lent had existed back then, John would have loved Lent. Like it was, that was his season. And so he had a group of people that started following him and his message. And then Jesus comes along and a group of guys start following Jesus. And John's disciples are like, they're not fasting. What's going on? In fact, it seems like they're partying a lot. Like every time we turn around, they're at a feast or they're at a wedding or they're celebrating or they're eating dinner or they're having a big meal or they're sharing a feast with people. Matthew and the tax collectors. And so they came and they asked Jesus, why is it that we fast? Because that's what we're supposed to do. And the Pharisees fast because that's what they're supposed to do. But we notice you and your disciples don't fast. Look at Jesus' response, verse 15. Jesus answered, how can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and then they will fast. So Jesus gives them an image. He basically says, well, here's the reason why we have feasts all the time. It's kind of like a wedding banquet, right? I mean, can you imagine a wedding banquet and the reception that follows and how people are just so celebrative and so joyful? They don't fast then. I mean, could you imagine? We had a wedding here at our church this past week, and downstairs they set up tables and they moved all the chairs and they set up, the DJ came in and had these huge speakers and they had this room for dancing to have. Can you imagine the bride and groom going down there to all of the people that were gathered and saying, hey, we're so glad you came, but today is a day of mourning. So there's not going to be any food. Sorry, no cake, no champagne, no wine, no dancing. Set all this up for no reason. We're going to fast. Like that would never happen. I mean, that's just not what happens at weddings. At a wedding, you celebrate. You're full of joy. And everyone's invited to celebrate, right? Everyone is. In fact, Jesus told a story one time about a wedding banquet where the people went out in the streets and said, everybody can come to the banquet. And they're pulling people off the streets saying, come and celebrate what's happening. And so Jesus says, that's why we don't fast. We are celebrating. Now, if for some reason the groom was taken away, if something happened to him, if there was a reason to grieve, then you would grieve and fast. And it's sort of a cryptic statement, and it's almost as if Jesus is pointing forward to the cross. There'll be a time to grieve and fast, but the time is not now. This is a time of celebrating what God is up to, because God is doing something new. And then Jesus drives it home by giving the people two final illustrations or images. Look at what he says, verse 16. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do people pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved. Now, these can be a bit hard to understand at first, so let me explain them real quickly. If you have an old garment, old pair of jeans, you've washed it over and over and over, it's shrunk and it's gotten to like the perfect size, like, and you don't want to get rid of it because it's great, but there's a tear in it and you want to put a patch or a new piece of cloth on it. Jesus says you wouldn't put a new piece of unshrunken cloth on it, because if you sewed it onto the old piece that's already shrunk, the first time you washed it, the new cloth would shrink and it would rip and tear at all the old cloth. In other words, you can't just add something new to something old. And then he says it's like wine and wineskins, which people drink, by the way, at feasts. New wine needs time to ferment. When you make new wine, it's like grape juice, and it needs time to sit and ferment, and there are chemical processes that take place. And so it bubbles and expands and it lets off gas. And so you have to put new wine into new wineskins. If you put it into an old container, an old wineskin, that's already been sort of expanded and shrunk, and then it's going to expand and it's going to break the old wineskin, and you'll lose all the wine and it'll break the container. It just doesn't work that way. You need to put new wineskin into a container that's expandable and new for it. In other words, you can't just put something new on something old. The container itself has to be new. And essentially what Jesus is saying is, I'm bringing an entirely new perspective. I'm bringing an entirely new understanding of who God is and what he is up to in the world. And you're going to have to let go of your old paradigms, your old expectations, your old understandings of God. And if you don't let go of them, if you just try to add a little bit of this new to your old life and to your old paradigms and your old understandings and your old worldview, it's not going to work. You will always be frustrated. It's not going to make sense for you. You can't understand why I'm hanging out with Matthew and his friends. And that's because your whole worldview is wrong. Your whole understanding of how God works is wrong. Your whole understanding of the feast that God invites everyone into is wrong. You need a new perspective. You need to see the kingdom as a feast where everyone is included. You need to see that Jesus is inviting you and inviting everyone to have a feast with him. True feasting is characterized by three things. If you're taking any notes, just write down three words today. True feasting is characterized by embrace, mercy, and joy. Embrace, because true feasting embraces everybody. It says at God's table, everyone is welcome. Everyone is invited and everyone is accepted. Nobody is excluded. And Jesus would tell all kinds of stories about a great feast that God hosts, and he welcomes everyone. And it's not just for Jews. He says people, Gentiles from all over, from the east and the west and the north and south are going to be invited, which is good news for most of us, right? And he says even the down and out, even the marginalized, all the people who have messed up lives, they're invited too. Everybody is invited. True feasting is known by its embrace of everyone. It's also known by its mercy. Because at God's feast and at God's table, that's where you receive mercy. And that's where you embrace mercy. You see, the Pharisees had it backwards. Because here's what the Pharisees said. Get your life together, clean up your act, and become pure, and then you can come eat with us. Jesus said, come eat with me. You're welcome and accepted and loved here. And I'll help you clean up your act and get your life together and become pure. And could there be any greater example of that than him sitting at the table with Matthew and all of his friends who live messed up lives, who have entire vocations and lives that are headed in the wrong direction? And Jesus saying, that's okay. We'll work through all that. Just start following me. See, true feasting, it's known by embrace and by mercy, but it's also known by joy. It's like a wedding feast. We celebrate at God's table. And so for followers of Jesus, our entire lives and our entire outlook should be one of joy. Not sort of the situational joy that's like, well, I had a pretty good day today. Not that kind of joy, or the traffic wasn't too bad this morning. Not like a deep, abiding sense of joy that God always welcomes me and loves me. And he showed it when he ultimately died on the cross for me. And then he rose from the dead. A deep joy in that. And it doesn't mean there won't be difficult seasons in our lives. It doesn't mean there won't be hard times. It doesn't mean there's not sorrow or grieving or even times for fasting. I was visiting somebody in the hospital yesterday. It's a tough time for them. It's a time of sorrow and difficulty and brokenness. And even Lent is a season of that. And yet Lent sort of stands as such a stark contrast to the rest of our lives, because our lives should overwhelmingly be characterized by joy. That it stands out when we stop and we look inward and we're sorrowful and we repent, because most of our lives is coming together and even on Sundays celebrating the goodness and the grace and the mercy that Jesus gives us. And the point of what Jesus tries to say to the people listening to him is, you can't just add a little bit of that onto your existing life. You can't just add a little bit of Jesus. You can't just add a little bit of embrace or a little bit of mercy or a little bit of joy. If you try to add a little bit of the new onto the old, you will always be frustrated and it's never going to work, because I came to entirely replace the old. And so if you want to follow me, and if you're open to that, and if you want to welcome that, and if you want to be open to the way I can reshape your entire understanding of God and reality in this world, then come and follow me. During Lent, we gather here on Sundays to still worship and to still celebrate and to remember that we're all invited to God's table. And it's really about embrace and mercy and joy. And we do that probably better than any other time when we come to the communion table. And so this morning, we're going to participate in communion, because on the night that Jesus went to the cross, he shared a feast with his followers. It was a Passover feast, because essentially what they were doing when they gathered for the Passover feast is they were remembering when God delivered the people of Israel from bondage in Egypt, and he rescued them and he showed mercy towards them. And so Jesus gathers followers and they're celebrating this, and he takes the bread and he says, but God is up to something new. The bread represents my body. It's going to be broken for you. The cup represents my blood. It's going to be poured out for you. God didn't just come to redeem Israel. God came to redeem and restore all of humanity. And you're all invited to the table of God's embrace, mercy, and joy. And so we celebrate communion here regularly, and we're going to do this now. And if you're new to this or you're new to our church, it can seem a bit strange, but essentially we're going to sing a song now. And during that song, at any point, you can just come forward and you just slip out of your seat. And there's two tables up here, and there's even a table in the back. You can go to any of those and you'll just grab a piece of bread and you'll break it off and you'll dip it in the juice and you'll eat it. And it's just it's a symbol. And it's a way to remember and proclaim God embraces you and me. God shows us mercy, and we can receive his joy. So let me pray for us now, and then we'll do that together. God, we come to the table today not in mourning or sorrow, but we come as people looking for your grace and your mercy. And we're grateful for all you've done in our lives. And I pray that even as we do this, you would renew that grace and mercy in our lives. As we come to the table expressing our faith or renewing our faith in you and what you did for us on the cross, God, we just say thank you. Thank you for inviting us. now, before we come to the table, let's all just say this prayer, a confession together. We'll put the words on the screen.